Well, Reboot, I already give you an introduction about what I will talk and what I will not talk about. So, cravo-turbulent star formation is one of the paradigms brought forward by Mordecai Mark McLowe and by Ralph Klessen. Oh, there's already something coming. And this would be certainly a perfect topic in the overall framework of this workshop. And so we took this basically as a basic idea for our investigations from a slightly different field, from a side field of star formation. And the wonderful side field of star formation that I will talk about is a little bit planet formation. So it's sneaking in here. So there we are. Just one second more. And we are now transporting this process, which plays a role in the molecular clouds, into a different environment, which are the protoplanetary disk. But in general, it's just any circumstellar disk, be it a disk around a protostar or a high mass star, which is just in the process of forming. And here. So just as I mentioned, so you see here a wonderful simulation by Esteros Paredes and Ralph Klessen. So wonderful formation of stars here and there, turbulent flow. And this would be almost what I'm talking about, but I sneaked in two things. One here, I put in here dust in addition to turbulence and gravity, and then I removed here the stars and went to slightly smaller objects, planetesimals with only a few hundred kilometers in size. So most of the simulations, basically all of them I present today, were done by Anders Johansen, our PhD student at MPIA. This is the biggest part of his PhD thesis. But further collaborators are, of course, Thomas Henning, Jeffrey Oichi, Mordecai Mark McLowe, and Andrew Uden on certain aspects. So gravi-turbulent star formation has already some key issues. I do not know what are your opinions about this, but one of the properties here is that you have an interaction between gravity and supersonic turbulence going on. And the turbulence in this paradigm has two roles. It first takes care that the large scales are stable towards collapse, but that there is collapse on the small scales. And I want to show you that very similar things are happening in circumstellar disks in the process of possibly planet formation. So I could also have in a different community, I would have called it that I would talk about from boulders to planetesimals and the meter barrier. So I do not know how everyone is familiar with all the many problems in planet formation. I want to give you an introduction on this today. So roughly, I will talk about very generally about dust, gas, and how it's interacting via turbulence. I will introduce you to some of our problems in planetesimal formation theory, show you the wonderful all-in-one simulation about gravi-turbulence, and then are coming with the simulation results to the conclusions. So what I will talk about takes place long after the infall, the formation of the star. It's the material left in the disk around the star, be it here at this very early stage with still outflows and infall, and even in the later isolated case where you see already indicated some things forming in here. But basically right now no one has a clue when actually planet formation started, whether this was during the infall stage or much later in a quiet disk. So it could be at any time. It does not matter for this work. Very schematically, what people believe is that you have here a disk. So initially it's full with very tiny small dust grains. They are producing the opacity. Those are the ones important for the radiation transport. They are clumping up in a process called coagulation to larger and larger things, eventually sedimenting to the midplane, and voila, in the end you have here some bigger objects formed. Now, the turbulence has now very different, distinct influences on these dust grains. So, of course, sedimentation is prevented because things are stirred up just like on a storm on Earth. There's also a diffusive transport of grains. So you have local concentration of boulders, which I will show you later, and you of course also generating collisions between the dust grains. So something very different to anything in star formation, where you have collision-less systems. Stars do not that often collide, but here collisions eventually will become important. So you can basically make two groups out of this. You have here the red things. This is mainly important for very tiny dust grains, so also the ones which are providing you with the opacity, so sub-millimeter grains. And you have larger things, let's say, so the meter regime, so already boulders, and they are the ones being concentrated and brought to colliding each
That's
other.
That's true, though, because the nitron guys are concentrating even better.
Sorry, I'm always talking in size words for circumstellar disks. I should actually speak about
the anti-micron guys are relevant for this. They're the red guys.
Yeah.
What? The micron guys.
Yeah.
Cluster by the turbulence better than the boulder.
This is just a question on what densities you have, so I would have to rephrase this. So one can then talk about Stokes numbers. You have typical eddy frequencies in their orbital periods, and now it's always the ratio between the basically the friction times, the coupling time of dust particles to the flow, and the turnover time of certain eddies, and this gives you the right size criteria. But I'm always scaling this to certain conditions in the disk so that people, our observers, do understand what sizes I'm talking about. So,
the coagulation always precedes sedimentation, so you coagulate all disk heights and then you start the sedimentation process?
Exactly, yeah. You can derive, if you're starting with submicron sized particles, the sedimentation time is many billion years, so there nothing happens, and only if the nebula is completely quiet. On the other hand, as soon as you're slightly larger, let's say roughly a millimeter, then suddenly sedimentation plays a role in the coagulation process itself. So initially it's just Brownian motion, which is bringing particles to collide with each other, but as soon as they are slightly decoupling from the gas, let's say a millimeter, the faster sedimenting, the larger they are. So they are sweeping up everything on their way. That's why actually the coagulation time is shorter away from the disk midplane than actually in the midplane. And then, so this later takes over.
This also, I guess, since also the turbulence adds an extra velocity to the dust particles.
Yes.
In terms of the collision frequency, it decreases the density, technically by raising the scale up, but it also increases the collision frequency.
Right.
It's two competing effects.
Yes. So, but this is all what I mean. It generates collisions, it's controlling it, and just by also doing the local concentration of boulders also means that you have stronger concentration there. So, in general, one can write down very simple equations of what particles are doing in turbulence. I'm writing down here an equation, a momentum equation for the gas, for you have here your wonderful pressure gradient, and you could up here also the magnetic forces, plus some forces just given from your system, which is the gravity of the central object and the centrifugal forces just by orbiting in this disk environment. If you're now writing down the same equations for the dust here, then you see there is no pressure. Of course, it's a pressureless, you can treat it as a pressureless fluid, your dust component. You have here a coupling term. So this is the friction time I talked about. It gives you the coupling strength between the dust motion and the gas motion. And again, you have very similar forces on the right side, where I mean here again the gravity of the star, which is the same, and the overall rotation of the disk. And if you're just subtracting these both equations and assume that it's a closely coupled system, then you can derive this equation that the dust motion is in the first order approach, just the gas motion plus a small correction, which you see here. And it's just proportional to the pressure gradient. So, because this is the only force which the particles do not feel. If you're slightly more accurate, you will also have to add here just the magnetic pressure or whatever pressure forces you're considering here in more detail. And this means that particles are just moving opposite to the pressure gradient. They are moving upward any pressure gradient in our turbulent disk flows here. Okay. This already explains you a property of disks and particles in them. I have here particle sizes, and I've here plotted here something I call drift time. And this is the radial drift of particles towards the central objects. So, as I said before, particles are feeling all the forces, centrifugal force, and also the gravity of the central object, but they do not feel the radial pressure gradient in the disk. And this makes them move towards the star. And the larger the particles are, starting with this 0.1 centimeters, the shorter the drift times become. And this is not already the first problem in planetesimal formation, because the growth time is pretty much independent on size. And this means as soon as you're above, let's say here, the 10 centimeter to the meter regime, your particles are drifting faster to the central object than they are growing. And this means basically they don't grow and they just fall into the star. Number one in planetesimal formation. So, if you're now thinking about the interaction between turbulence and particles, there are different scenarios. There is one condition I call the lab condition. This is a system which does not have gravity, which does not have rotation, which does not have any pressure stratification, and so on. This is basically what you're simulating in your Earth turbulence, but which is also very important for what Paolo is working on in his concentration in interstellar turbulence. So, you have two cases. Let's say turbulence consists of eddies. Then you see here a particle sitting in this wonderful eddies, and now the force is the centrifugal force, which is just accelerating your particle out of these of this vortex. You can have concentration in such turbulence if you're just looking in the interaction in the convergence zone of the turbulence. And then it's very easy to see that if you have just the interaction between four vortices here, then more particles will just pile up in this relatively quiet zone in here between the vortices. So, if you're now going to a disk, you have various effects, like for instance a vertically varying gravity gradient. If you're going to an accretion disk, you will see that in the vertical direction you have a harmonic potential. So gravity is roughly proportional to omega squared times z. So in the midplane you have zero effective gravity acting, and the further you go away from the midplane, the stronger it pulls you down. If you now have such a vertical vortex in the disk, so radial vertical direction, like for instance a random pattern turbulence, but also convection cells, like this stuff, then you find that the differential drifting sedimentation speed in the lower half and in the upper half leads again to a concentration inside the vortices.
Is this the Stokes number?
Yes, so they are optimum Stokes numbers. If the Stokes number is too small, then the relative drift motion between particles and gas is too small to have any effects. If the particles are too large, again, they don't care about the gas anymore. So you have always such an optimum regime so that the overturn times or the orbital frequency is proportional or is in the same order as the orbital period. So everything has to be in the order of omega. There's one famous possibility to concentrate particles by Barsch and Sommeria. These are vortices in the midplane of the disk. So this is the azimuthal direction, the radial direction, and you see your particles being spiraling into this anticyclonic vortex. Or more general possibility that you have a local, here you see this is a gas distribution in a disk over the radius. So here at 70 AU, you have a very tiny maximum in the surface density and thus and the pressure of the disk gas, and this means that all the particles are now concentrating in this ring. Particles want to be at places of maximum pressure. the vortex picture can be either understood while you're concentrating dust in there if you're doing a very detailed analysis of the epicyclic frequency and the Coriolis forces acting, which then give you an effective force concentrating things inside the vortex. You see here a particle which is spiraling inside. So you see here also other paths. This means these are smaller particles, and it simply takes longer to concentrate them in there. But also for these vortices, the following is true, that again, dust is being concentrated at the place of maximum pressure, because again, these vortices are in a so-called geostrophic balance, and this means that the Coriolis forces and centrifugal forces here are balanced by pressure gradients, just like here in the Earth system, where also the high pressure regions are the anticyclonic vortices and the low pressure regions are the cyclonic ones, the cyclones, bringing us rain and bad weather and clouds. So you see here again, dust is being concentrated here in this high pressure regime. So this is basically an overview of the various types of influence of flow with particles. If there is no global turbulence to stir up things, then things would be sedimenting to the midplane. And this would be basically a kind of global instability coming back to star formation. So if there is no turbulence, then you could have global modes, and the dust could simply collapse to planetesimals and even larger planets. But as soon as stuff is sedimenting to the midplane, you will reach a state where you have more dust than gas locally. And this is usually before gravity takes over. And as soon as you have dust taking over the dynamics, it's no longer subkeplerian motion, as the gas does, but it's Keplerian. And now you get in the vertical direction a shear layer. So the midplane, dust loaded, is Keplerian, the upper layers are subkeplerian. And now you're driving Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. And Anders has done a nice simulation of this, which of course I have to show you. You see here the dust layer as it's sedimenting towards the midplane. Everything is still fine, and now you're driving the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, and everything is getting very active. And this was a reason why people for a long time believed that in this scenario you will never form planetesimals. Just to give you an overview of what the current ideas are for planetesimal formation, so these many kilometer-sized objects, precursors of our planet Earth, it's about the following. You can order them by either taking place in a non-turbulent disk or in a turbulent disk. So as long as we do not know, Eric, how good alpha is and when it will die out and when live, then both have to be investigated. There are also two different methods, either by a coagulation, this means hit and stick, or by having some kind of gravitational collapse, that gravity is the binding force. And I put here in some names, which are some proposers of the various theories. So problems are, of course, connected to all of those models. As I already said, if you're just coagulating and are non-turbulent, then the radial drift is too fast and everything just gets lost. If it's turbulent, then you have just bouncing. So because if you're shooting 2-centimeter-sized stones together, it's very difficult to make them stick unless you have super glue or something like this. And it's not known that anything like this was present in space. And even more, you have collisional destruction. So those small boulders are very fragile, so even a few meters per second and you are back to your debris. Gravitational collapse, we already heard that you don't have the thin midplane layer usually, because and that's not the gravitational instability, that's not the global gravitational instability, because your Kelvin-Helmholtz turbulence is stirring up everything again, and everything becomes very, very turbulent in there. Okay, so you don't have a thin midplane, but again, your stuff is vertically diffused out of this. But locally, you're still forming high densities and bringing back, so you have either turbulence per se from the disk, already in some magnetic sense, or here the sedimentation towards the midplane again leads you to turbulence. So the way how we are now investigating the particle behavior in turbulent disk is the following. So here is your disk. We are not calculating the entire disk. We are taking out a nice, wonderful little box here. We are using the pencil code by Axel and Wolfgang. And having here now our local shearing sheet coordinate system and using, as I said, Joe, the pencil code to do this. It's very simple. You're putting in it. This is a simulation without any vertical net field simulations like Eric has been just talking about, and you see just after a small perturbation, your entire system goes crazy and saturates at some certain turbulence values. So what we had been doing with this at the very first time is to investigate small grains, here in the size range between 0.1 micron up to 1 centimeter, respectively, if you put them into 5 astronomical units. But as I said before, so what really matters is the coupling time between the particle and the gas. So if this coupling time is very short in comparison to the orbital period, then you can talk about small grains. So friction time is much smaller than an orbital period. So you can really think that if you have a meter-sized object at 5 AU, it takes about 10 years to slow it down just by gas friction. So, and if you have smaller things, it of course goes faster. First thing we were looking for is just to see what happens with diffusion. So in order to measure diffusion, just seeing whether our algorithm works, we were putting into our box here a second fluid. It was just called the pressureless dust fluid. And just the turbulence was now taking care that the material gets distributed in this box. It's diffusing away. So our actual measurements we were then doing with some forces, trying to bring particles together and then measuring scale heights in there. One thing you already see in this movie is that the diffusion in the radial direction seems to be faster and stronger than in the vertical direction. We were then measuring this effect quite carefully in a series of simulations. I just want to show you here, I was just putting this plot in again because Eric's talk before, effect of imposed magnetic field. So as long as we don't know what the proper field properties are in our circumstellar disk, we will never know how strong our turbulence is. So the imposed magnetic field giving you the initial beta value. So here you have our, in some arbitrary numbers, our imposed field from zero net field imposed to the disk up to 0.08 in this arbitrary numbers. So I think this refers now to a beta value of roughly 200. If I'm not mistaken, yes, roughly 200, where this would be infinity. So, and you see, of course, as soon as your vertical field strength increases, you're raising from 2 times 10 to minus 3 in alpha up to very close to 1. So very super strong turbulence, which also changes its character. So it's not only that it's stronger, but you suddenly have something called a channeled solution. So very global, violent flows in the disk here. But coming back to the diffusion, it also has influence on the diffusion of particles. So you already see there are two different lines here. So what I'm plotting here is again the alpha value, which we measured in our simulations. And here's something called the Schmidt number. And the Schmidt number is just the ratio between diffusivity and viscosity. So telling you in a perfect fluid, of course, the Schmidt number would be 1, that particles are in the same way being diffused as viscosity is being distributed. But you see that this is roughly true for the low alpha cases, but the stronger the field is and the stronger alpha becomes, the more diffusion deviates from viscosity. And there's also strong deviation between, so not to confuse this now, vertical and radial diffusion. So radial diffusion is about 2 times, on the average, 2 times stronger than radial stronger than vertical diffusion in the disk, already showing you another property of turbulence in the disk. So the alpha is for many ways a tricky concept for disk, as soon as you're really considering 3D flows. No one says that the vertical viscosity would be anywhere similar to radial or azimuthal component. But, of course, turbulence is not only diffusing stuff, it is also doing things like size segregation. So, because friction time determines the behavior, different sizes have different friction times. It does local concentration of intermediate size solids. And one thing here is basically how you can see it, the subsonic turbulence of the gas. So in a disk, you're typically Mach numbers are maybe 10% of the sound speed. So 0.1 would be typical for some MRI turbulence in the disk. But this, of course, introduces an RMS velocity in the dust component. The dust, on the other hand, is a pressureless fluid. And this means that any turbulence now generated in the dust is basically supersonic turbulence.
Why is the dust pressureless? It's because its random velocity is much less than that of
the gas? No, because it's basically collision-free.
It doesn't matter about it. Pressure is not defined in terms of collisions. The average of,
Okay, that's true. So, okay, then the point is basically that the velocities introduced onto the dust are determined by the large scales. And this means that the RMS velocity is then given by the largest velocities in the box giving on the largest Kolmogorov scale, where the energy is being injected. On the other hand, the pressure would be determined from the local RMS. And this is, of course, much smaller. And this means the overall motion of the particles gives you stability on the large scales, but not on the small scales anymore. Right. So this was a simulation of just centimeter-sized objects. And there you already saw a plus minus 25% variation in the dust to gas ratio. So if you have smaller than centimeter sized things, this is dramatically going down. So among the millimeter and submillimeter sized particles, you cannot generate density fluctuations anymore. If you now investigate where are those low dust density and high dust density regions and correlate it with some of the flow properties like velocity, pressure, and so on, you're finding out that it's pretty much this weird function here which gives you a measure of the local vorticity content of the disk. And this strongly shows you that wherever you have anticyclonic vorticity, like here, you have higher dust-to-gas ratios than in regions where it's cyclonic. And this is, again, just this kind of vortex trapping of dust particles. If you're going to larger objects, things become even more dramatic. Now no longer centimeter, but meter is now our goal. So the friction time...
How do you make a meter first?
Excuse me?
How do you make a meter-size object first?
We are just taking them as to be meters. Well, if you're taking coagulation simulations where people are having already collisions in their fragmentation and so on, they can make it up to roughly this order. Let's say 10 centimeters, 20 centimeters.
I assume that things stick.
In the slow thing, yes. And this does stick because it's enough that you assume that you have a sweeping up process. That it's basically just a centimeter-sized guy which is sweeping up micron-sized dust. And this is the same coagulation process that you have in the corner of your room, under your bed, so that it's just this very tiny things which has super surface strength. And one can hope that this does lead to macroscopic objects. No, this is they are the main coagulation force, driving force is drift radial in the radial direction.
Yeah, but as you mentioned, it does not account for the fact that it lost the particle before becoming a meter.
No, but I'm not referring to simulations where drift and fragmentation, everything is in.
But okay, I was referring to the radial drift, not to the sticking. No, I actually said sticking, but the radial drift is a real problem, right?
It's at 1 meter. So this is one now the funny thing. So
you said 10 centimeter, I think it's like
Yeah, this depends on where in the disk you are, so where it starts to be a problem, yes, correct. But this is related. So things which are drifting fast are also being concentrated fast, because the drift is part of the concentration process, basically a variation in the radial drift velocity. So but what you basically want to do is you want to have them drift fast, but you want to catch them somewhere. This can be now in a pressure bump or vortex or whatever. So previously I said we were treating the particles as a pressureless gas. But now for this approach, this is again just the equation now in our shearing sheet for the hydrodynamic MHD part. Now these are the particles. You see the derivatives have slightly changed. It's now in the Lagrange picture, you have individual particles being interacting with the gas. And here you have your friction term. So it looks like this. So we are just plotting a part of the particles. Initially they are all in the bottom of the disk, and now they are being stirred around. But eventually you see that they are forming these density sheets in here. On the average, they are also drifting radially inward, but sometimes the radial drift is being slowed down. You can see this here if you're plotting the radial drift velocity. So the dashed line here is a theoretical prediction for radial drift. But now that we have this turbulence in there, the drift rate is fluctuating, so it's already averaged over the entire volume. And you see it's decreased by a slight already 50%. This means you have already had pressure trapping in your flow. What you also have is local concentration of particles. So this is the particle density in units of the initial density. So here, one would have been the average density. But now in the course of the run, you're always eventually creating over-density in the dust-to-gas ratio, which is living here, let's say, for a fraction of an orbital period. And these over-densities can be very dramatic. So like here, 80 times more dust than you had initially in your box.
But you mentioned that the drifting does the coagulation. It's not the case here, right? Because they're all 1 meter, so they all drift at the same speed. That was the problem. This is all due to the fluctuations in the flow.
This is just one size of particles. Yes,
so
right.
So these concentrations are only due to the turbulent fluctuation.
Yes. It's the overlap, so between both. So the interaction between turbulence and the particles is that you have variations in your drift velocity. So you have sometimes places where...
But the
drift velocity is in the order of the turbulent generated velocity. And this means you have a very funny interaction. You cannot simply subtract the radial drift velocity. It's very essential for this.
I mean, it's over the unit for the particle. It's over the unit. The delta B over B drift.
Exactly.
Is over the unit.
Right. And this basically gives you then the chance to trap them eventually in these high density regions. So it's not the flow which is transporting them there, but it's the density fluctuation in the gas which makes them stop there. So if we have such high densities of particles, we were already doing some back on the envelope simulations, we were thinking that we are reaching the critical genes mass, so something could happen there. There's one more criterion in comparison to star formation. You have this nasty star in the center, and this means you have tidal forces, so you must not be too big. So anything what you want to form by self-gravity has to be in its own Roche lobe, and this gives you one additional criterion here for how high your densities have to be.
Yeah. Have you ever done a simulation where there is no radial drift, no shearing boxes, just turbulence and the same environmental velocity of the turbulence? But everything else is identical, but you don't have any net drift, only the turbulence.
Yeah. What, and? Yeah?
Have you ever tried that experiment? With a meter size holder. Everything else is
a zero drift. I don't remember. We did certainly variations in the drift velocity, stronger and weaker drift, and then saw, of course, effects in the densities that we reached.
So if you make weaker drift, the density fluctuations are weaker as well?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Are they bigger in high resolution simulations?
Excuse me?
Are the density fluctuations larger in high resolution simulations?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
So, this was. This is something I will show something about resolution a little bit later, which is exactly referring to this.
When you get these concentrations, what about the collisions and the shadowing? Is that important or not?
This is very important. So it has a good side because this gives you an important cooling contribution. So we were doing simulations without collisional cooling and with collisional cooling. So we were just giving this as an additional removing kinetic energy. And if you have collisions, you your process is more efficient. You have shorter, but just by having shorter. That's another problem, which we have not solved right now. Collisions, as Olga also said before, are still a big problem in already getting to this centimeter-sized object. So this is still pretty much not understood. Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Again, now you have your wonderful MHD equations again here, and down here you have the particles. I'm showing the equations because there are some new terms we introduced. So you not only have here the friction between the particles and the gas, slowing down the particles, but you have here the corresponding term also now in the gas equation. It's now the feedback of those high dust concentrations onto the gas. Only if you have this feedback, you can, for instance, treat the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. So that was already introduced. We are having now also here the Poisson equation of dust and gas. And of course, the gravity is acting here on the particles as well as on the gas. We have chosen a disk which has by itself Coulomb values above 10. So self-gravity within the gas does not play a role, but in the but of course in the dust component. First, I want to show you the effect of this back coupling. Oh, of course, this is just the little thing we have to run it on. The effect of back coupling. So what you have here is just a system which is where there's only radial drift, no vertical gravity, no MHD, no turbulence. You just have here an initial distribution of dust grains, and they now start to drift radially inward. And then what? Oh, sorry, wrong movie. Damn it. Okay. So it's including radial. Ah, you also see it here very quickly. Okay, a more simple case would have been without the vertical gravity, but here you see basically the same effect. See these clumps here? The overall motion of the gas would be faster, but they are moving slower. Why is that? So this is because as soon as you have more dust in a local cell than you have gas, you are no longer in this disk dynamics with subkeplerian motion and so on. And this means as soon as you're concentrating your dust locally, it does not want to drift anymore because it's a pressure gradient of the gas which determines the radial drift. If the dust is dominating, there is no drift anymore. But the other, the not so strong concentrated dust grains are now plunging in from the backside. You have basically this truck on the 101 making the full stop there, and then all the other cars are crashing in from the backside. That's why we're also calling it the traffic jam instability here.
That's only true for an enhanced dust to dust ratio, otherwise you wouldn't see it.
You're starting with very low dust to it. It's already an effect if you're increasing your dust to gas ratio from 1% to 1.5%. It's linear instability. So Andrew Uden has worked this out very nicely on paper. And Anders was then able to show the nonlinear evolution of this entire system.
The growth rate is completely different. It's much larger. The growth rate depends very strongly on the dust to gas ratio.
It's a linear instability. So. Well, what do you mean?
I remember plots in their paper where the dust to gas ratio was the fundamental parameter. With the low dust to gas ratio, we basically don't see any effect.
Right, so to get.
Because the growth rate is very strongly dependent on the dust to gas ratio. Sometimes
and on the particle size, friction time.
No, dust to gas ratio was the key parameter.
Okay. So this is the simulation which now includes everything. Oh. Should start, because it should start by itself. here. You see again, so this is now only the dust component in the disk. It's a slice through the midplane. You see here these filaments forming in the dust. Now the first high object gravity concentrated object has formed. You see here a blow up. Here's a thing confined by gravity, just dust. You see how it's interacting with the other material floating around, having this wonderful tidally introduced spiral waves around it, and is growing and getting more and more fat. So we are doing this, of course, because we had some criticism before with one particle size, but with four different particle sizes at the same time, between 15 centimeters and 60 centimeters. So we already have a particle size distribution to be more realistic. And you see here also a circle in the blow up, and this is huge, is now the Roche lobe of the object which has formed. So once you have enough mass in your Roche lobe, it cannot be destroyed anymore. It was nice to see that the different particle sizes were all having the different amplitudes of concentration, but at least at the same places. So
we still have there's no coagulation.
There's no coagulation because coagulation does not take place on, takes place on a few orbits. So a typical coagulation time would be 1,000 years. So just to compare this again to the gravitational fragmentation picture by Ralf. What I want to show you here is the actual outcome of this simulation. So this is the initial phase we have, where we have not turned on gravity yet, just we wanted to get some initial distribution of particles. Here we are turning it on, and immediately here this object forms. What we are plotting here is the particle density. We can also measure the mass in the Roche lobe, and this is starting here with roughly one Ceres mass, so this is already a 100 kilometer sized object, and very quickly increasing to this 3.5 Ceres masses in this variable. So basically cleaning out our entire box. And now we come to the resolution effect. So this simulation I showed you before was 256 cubed. This was the maximum we can do right now with our computer.
How many particles?
20 million. Something like this, I forgot the proper number. Should be somewhere down there. And 256 was the maximum because we have to run this entire system for more than 100 sun crossing times. So it's quite expensive, so it's already 2 weeks. We could do lower resolution, so 64 cubed and 128 cubed. And what you see here is that in the low resolution cases, you have to increase your overall dust to gas ratio from the beginning. And this results then in larger Ceres objects. The point is that the relative overdensities are weaker in the lower resolved cases. So the higher our resolution is, the higher our relative concentrations become. And of course, we have no convergence yet in this system. Yeah, so for the quantitative understanding, we need still to figure out when and where in the disk will we have what number and size distribution of solids. So basically what Olga was asking. So this is business for other people. They have to give us the right size distributions. So when is what and where the strength of the turbulence in the disk. Right now, nobody knows what the proper alpha values are, whether there are dead zones in the disk, whether there's how big there is layered accretion, so on. All this will play a role. Collisional destruction during the collapse and coagulation as well could occur there. We have no idea yet what the effect will be. Also, we are now talking to meteoriticists. They where we want to know whether this has any influence, that there never were 10 meter sized objects, that you were directly taking the jump from 1 meter to 100 kilometer. So far, they say it could, planetesimal formation could work in this gravitational collapse thing. We were surprised that the objects are pretty large, 100 to 1,000 kilometers. But this is very similar to the original work by Goldreich and Ward. It's basically related to the RMS velocity that you will have in the dust, which determines this value here. And of course, future work will have to be a quantitative understanding of this entire process. So thanks a lot for following me into the world of planets. Thanks.
I missed the point that you just said about the one front from 10 meters to 10 kilometers orders of what we should. That's, I mean, it's, so the question is how do you jump from 10 meter size to 10 kilometer size object?
It would be completely enough to solve the planetesimal mystery to jump from, let's say, 10 centimeters to 50 or 100 meters.
Oh.
Because in this regime, coagulation and drift, everything does not work. So, but we were then surprised that the jump was even larger. So that we are not jumping to kilometer-sized objects, where for the first time, things could be attracted by gravity to the surface of the planetesimals, but we are already jumping to 100 and 1,000 kilometers.
You already got 100.
Yes, Ceres. So Ceres is close to 1,000 kilometers. Yes, right. So once gravity is started going, it's very super efficient. Yeah.
This must significantly affect your calculations for building up terrestrial planets and cores for giant planets, which are, do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, well, and when talking to my friends like at Thomas, their problems come later. So they are even if we are giving them 10 or no, they are starting with almost moon-sized objects. So if we already give them our Ceres things, it will still take 10 million years or so until they have grown the core of Jupiter. So it's again another unsolved problem in planet formation.
Do you think there's a version of that might play for the large mass of planets? In the accretion process.
That again, gravity takes over. I don't know. So, but if there are, let's formulate it this way. Everything depends on the surface density distribution in the solids. If they are not homogeneously distributed all over the disk, but concentrated at the edges of dead zones or the some other funny place in the disk, like the ice line or so, then and you have locally suddenly 10 times higher dust-to-gas ratio, then everything will work faster. The planetesimal formation as well as the core formation later. So.
We're actually investigating.
Right. Yeah. Right. So.
The scales of particles are larger because the effect of this turn of the spectrum is pretty dramatic because there is a size scale below which, you know, the dust be very, very small scales, dust is robustly coupled with the turn of motion. But then as it starts to grow, it is, it gets progressively less and less coupled. And then the time scale is then sort of heavy. Depending on the lifetime of the Yeti, et cetera, how coherent the philosophy. So the spectrum, or some range of scales, would affect the
It's what you can think about is if you're using your Kolmogorov spectrum and you're not plotting now the power or velocity, but the coherence time. What is the lifetime of the various structures? And then you see that the longest lived structures are, of course, the largest ones. So the smallest ones have short overturn times, slowly decay. And this is now the question how this couples with the particle friction time. And there you see that you have, if you have your meter-sized object, they are only coupling to the large scales. So, and they do not care about what happens on the
small
scales anymore.
Smaller
scales of particles.
Yeah,
yes. Yes. So the small scales and turbulence don't matter for the large objects.
Yeah.
So there we are already completely decoupled.
Yeah.
It's only for smaller particles, right? Where you would have then, in order to get the proper behavior, the integral over the entire spectrum. We can ignore this.
So is it true that your meter-sized objects are actually drifting straight towards the star in your simulated box? So
yes.
Apart from when they actually stop in the
right,
core.
Right.
You can actually, so it's not true that they will release over the unity. I thought they were moving kind of randomly, but also drifting at the same time.
Yeah.
If they're moving randomly, they're not always sensitive to the larger scale. I mean, also sensitive to the turbulence on intermediate and smaller scales.
No, no, that's what I mean. So it's dominated by the large scales. So,
how large? I mean, you said that the orbit, the friction time is of order the orbital time for the meter size object in the simulation.
Correct, yeah.
But the larger scale in the simulated box, the time scale is probably smaller than orbital time.
No, no, it's pretty much. So,
it's comparable to the outer scale of the simulation, is comparable to the orbital time.
Right, yeah. So the lifetime of the density fluctuations is in the order of one orbital period, of one orbit, or one or two orbits.
In MRI turbulence,
yeah.
The outer scale of Eddy is of order and orbital time.
Yeah.
I would expect it to be much shorter.
No, it's pretty much omega. Yeah.
Okay. And so, so then these boulder size are actually going around. Okay, so then there is danger that I pointed out from that angle that you're actually sensitive to the change in the power spectrum as well, somewhere.
Yeah.
So it would be nice to actually plot your power spectrum from the simulation.
It's in the papers, so yeah.
And it will be an answer to measure the Kolmogorov time, the effective Kolmogorov time in your simulation, and compare to the friction time of your meter size boulder, and see what is the effective Stokes number of those objects.
Right, right. You can divide it from there, but yes.
And because the simulation is not that large, and because the outer scale, so I suspect that the Stokes number is not much larger than 10 or 20.
For?
Very risky.
Okay.
For the boulders, but I may be wrong. And so if it is not larger than 10 or 20, then you're sensitive to the actual viscosity in the colder.
Mm-hmm.
I would just like to see the number. If you could compute or ask your answer to compute it.
Okay. We will ask him.
Another question. Is it sensitive, as Paul pointed out, is it still this work, this simulation is sensitive? I mean, the object's rate of, like, you calculating is still sensitive to the gas task ratio. So you have to get locally, you have to have a faster gas ratio of, like, water humidity or maybe.
In order to get to beyond this Roche density, you have to be 10 times, you need 10 times more dust to gas.
Okay.
And of course, so the, as I said, what we are determining by turbulence is a relative concentration relative to the initial density distribution of dust. And this means the higher your initial dust to gas ratio is, the less concentration you need on top of this. So, and the dust to gas ratio is basically now a free parameter where we can always determine the minimum for a given simulation in order still to have gravitational collapse.
Okay. And also a comment regarding that, how do you get the initial 1 meter size object? I think if you draw an analogy, just a naive thought, but if you draw an analogy of those dust bunnies in the corner and on your bed, and those things, if they coagulate to a kind of large size, to centimeters or meters, I can imagine they will not be broken up by the turbulence of gas. So I would suggest that you have to go through some kind of like particle formation process before you can do this meter size calculation.
Mm-hmm.
Start with meter size calculation, because you have to have some solid stuff that's more solid than the dust bunnies.
So that you have some thermal alteration of the material which makes it more solid.
Yeah.
Which I can see for conduits, but not for meter-sized objects. So and once you have conduits, these wonderful little pebbles, I don't think that they have any sticking afterwards. But we are leaving this problem to Jürgen Plum and Stu Weidenschilling and all these experimental and...
How do you build this 1 meter object? I mean,
this is what I want to know from them as well, yes. So one thing is that we are now pushing the limit. As you saw, we are now saying, okay, you don't need a meter, maybe 15 centimeters is enough.
For what initial dust to gas
though? Our typical value is 1%.
Also, it does work with 1% initially.
Yes.
So that's your minimum value is 1%.
Right. So this was in this simulation. If you're going to 64 cubed, your concentrations are less, then you need 3% or so. That's what we are playing with it.
So if you went to infinite resolution, you'd mean 0%.
This is what I'm afraid about. So no. But actually, then comes again these physical parameters eventually. So the RMS speed between the, so basically the temperature of the dust locally, which will then determine hopefully a minimum size.
What can you extrapolate?
Well, the same stuff like in Goldreich Watt stuff. So they are now coming here in this 100, but maybe 10 kilometers.
Okay, let's
open
your question.
Do you see any dependence on the box size?
Excuse me?
For the same disk property,
yeah.
Do you see any dependence of what you get out?
Oh, very good question. Latest work now. Now we're having bigger boxes, not having one pressure scale light, but 3, 2, 3, 4. And then these over densities which are being created are much longer lived.
Okay.
So you have now then suddenly times not omega, but even longer lived. And then also concentrations become stronger. So.
Do you see convergence in this case with the same resolution you have?
Not yet.
Okay.
So, because it's still not a global simulation, so it was just still boxes, but having many pressure scale heights, no convergence yet.
Okay, why don't we thank you very much.
Thank you.